Blog Talk Radio.
From Fairfax, Virginia, where it is a balmy, amazing 40 degrees Fahrenheit out. Snow is melting. I'm seeing blue skies and something that resembles what I heard once upon a time called sunshine. And maybe most of all, ground cover is beginning to emerge. There's green showing up. And in celebration of that, and the fact it's going to be about 20 degrees tomorrow, we're going to go ahead and start this week's Military Monday. My name is John Gresham. I'm your host, and we're going to have a little fun here today. Not that we haven't been having fun the past month or so with books, but we're going to have a little bit of fun because there is something that folks like myself love to do, and that is the subject of alternative history. For some of us, like author and novelist Harry Turtledove, it's rewriting the history of the world, be it the Civil War with Robert E. Lee's forces getting AK-47s, or my friend Larry Bond and myself and others replaying history with war games. But there's something else on the horizon that's beginning to take over, and that's alternative visual history. What would have happened if something different had happened or even had been built? Today we're going to talk to someone who's done a book about just that subject. In particular, what if a number of aircraft that were never built and put into series production during the Cold War actually had? What would they look like? How would they be painted? What kind of missions would they be on? And how would they be used? Our guest today is someone that I've had a lot of admiration for a number of years now. He is a friend of my family out in California, and I want to introduce everybody to Mr. Eric, that is Eric with a K, by the way, Simonson. Eric, are you there, sir? Hang on a second. Eric, are you there, sir?
Yes, I'm here. Pleased to be here. Thank you very much.
Eric, tell the folks a little bit about yourself. How did you get to be an artist, for lack of a better term? What path did you follow to get here?
Well, sort of a little bit of everything. I guess when you're a youngster, you're inspired by something, which we all try to instill in our youngsters today so that they take up something that they really have a passion for. And mine was during the 1950s in Miami, and Miami was just north of Homestead Air Force Base, and we were kids running around, and all these great airplanes were flying right overhead. And those of us old enough to remember the unique sound of a B-36, four pusher-type piston engines and four jet engines, well, they were operating out of Homestead, and they flew right over the city. So we'd sit on the roof in the hot sun of Miami with borrowed binoculars, looking at the airplanes that go over. And that was followed by...
And the B-36 was not a little airplane. It was a mammoth, monster aircraft.
Yeah, about 230-foot wingspan, and Convair built it, and it was during the Cold War, and they were in the air a lot. And, of course, the progression after that, B-47s. And in those days, they refueled air-to-air right over the city of Miami. And you could see the contrails and the two planes joining up, KC-97, B-47, and then after that, the KC-135. So this was great. And pretty soon I was building models and drawing pictures. And later on, after college and so forth, I got a little bit interested in astronomy in college, and actually started my career as a planetarium director. And I think that influenced my photography later on by creating special effects for the planetarium, which is those of us who've viewed planetarium shows know that you see some really cool three-dimensional lighting effects So that combined with astronomy was great, so it got me interested in the space program. And along with aviation, I was still building models, going to the airport at Miami International to shoot commercial planes, and also the homestead and the local air shows, air bases and so forth. So taking pictures and drawing pictures. I actually majored in commercial art and fine arts in college, but kind of drifted away from that and went into photography. I never really took a course in photography, just kind of evolved, but I'm here in my office surrounded by, you know, thousands and thousands of 35-millimeter slides and prints taken through the years, a lot of history. And, of course, as we all know, about 6 or 7 years ago, it switched over to digital. But you can scan slides sometimes taken, you know, 20, 30 years ago and make them look pretty good in the computer. So you are preserving that history. So after the planetarium career for a few years, I actually was lucky enough to get locked in with Rockwell and moved from the eastern United States out to Downey, California, began working on the space shuttle and communications. So this was great as the shuttle was gearing up during the 80s. The first launch was in 1981, and Rockwell had a lot of other interesting space programs. The GPS satellites were built there by Rockwell in those days, and space station proposals, a lot of X-craft and so forth. Went over, transferred to Rockwell's B-1 division for a while, and I was doing communications and public relations. And all the while, I was keeping my photography going at home on the side, still going to air shows. And once in a while, Rockwell would have me assist with some type of photo project or advertising and so forth. So I was able to keep that going. And as we know, all the mergers and acquisitions, Boeing purchased the aerospace and defense businesses of Rockwell in December 1996, and then I became a Boeing employee. Lots of great programs there. I was on the defense side of Boeing, which Boeing maintains 50% commercial and about 50% defense, a nice array of products. So all in all, I put in 30 years in aerospace, you know, after the planetarium work. So a lot of, and I was on the history committee of Boeing and learned a lot about the programs and did a lot of reading myself to make sure that I was up on World War II, even though that was before my time. I think it's everyone's duty to learn history and how we came about and how, you know, how precious freedom is when you read the history of Europe, you know, pre-World War II, and when you let yourself get weak and you're not strong and defenses get weak, a lot of things can go wrong. So I applied those bits of knowledge to studying the Cold War. And that's how the kind of the book evolved, because we're talking about programs basically emanating from the Cold War period. So all in all, I get to learn history and look at a lot of airplanes and rocket launches and space shuttle launches and landings and keep all those things going and kind of keep it well-rounded, a little bit of space, a little bit of aviation. So I applied all that to putting the book together.
Now, for our listeners, the book itself is called Project Terminated. And the publisher is in England, correct?
Yes, that's Cressy Publishing Limited in the UK. And the U.S. distributor for the book is Specialty Press in Minnesota.
Okay. And I guess the first question I have about this is, what in the world gave you the idea of creating these very sophisticated, very detailed, and very beautiful pieces of artwork about airplanes that, in some cases, never made it beyond a drawing board?
Well, it's the knowledge of history combined with a little bit of photographic technique. And I thought in the book is to actually put the story in there of the politics, the funding issues, and all the things that had to do with developing these programs. There's 10 chapters, and it's actually programs of the Cold War and what might have been. So each chapter kind of discusses the program and then whether it was, you know, was a good idea or not to cancel it. The second part of each chapter discusses, well, what if it had gone into service? Let's talk about that a little bit and what might it have looked like. So that took a lot of model building and photographing these things with special lighting and high resolution, putting them in the computer. And my wife, Sharon, works really hard on Photoshop techniques. And so we try to make it look like these airplanes are flying. You know, you try to establish an imaginary thought. When someone looks at it, they look at that picture and they go, wow, did that really fly? Does that look real? You want people to be guessing and not look at it and say, oh, you know, that's pretty, and that's a rendering or something like that. So that's been done before. You need to.
So you're not doing paintings like Keith Ferris or renderings like George Lucas and his people up at Skywalker. What is it you're actually producing? In other words, when I look at one of your photos, without going and taking off with all your artistic secrets, what am I actually looking at there? What are the pieces of each piece of art that I'm looking at?
Yeah, there's a lot of great artists out there. I know many of them, and that's a certain field, and they've got that covered pretty well. So I try to take photography, which gives you a more adamant three-dimensional object, and then you can combine photography, a precise photograph, so to speak, of an object, and then put it in a different background. And all the while, the secret of photography is, of course, lighting. And you have to control the horizon, the lighting, the time of day, the clouds, and everything to make it look like it's just not stuck in there. Because I even see, you know, professional advertising nowadays, and it looks pretty and everything, but you look at it and go, oh, that airplane's been stuck in that background. Well, you want to try to avoid that. You want to control your angle of attack. Make sure a large airplane, like a bomber or an airliner, is not nose-down attitude flying, you know, with the horizon. You can look at the horizon behind it, and you want to make sure that's all correct. With fighters, there's a little more leeway on if it's diving or climbing and so forth. So you want to be able to control all those aspects. So it's a question of shooting the model.
And this is an actual scale model aircraft you're shooting. Then you're lighting it externally. You're actually lighting it as you shoot it, correct?
Yes, in most cases, I'm doing that. Although you can still do a lot with it, you can actually morph some things when you have the picture in the computer. You can change some shapes in the wings and different things like that, even though you were not holding that model exactly how it winds up looking at the end. So there's a lot of aspects of that as far as changing the actual aircraft or spacecraft, you know, once it's in the computer. But it also, you have to go out and through the years I've been shooting. There's a lot of pictures of just straight airplane shots in the book because I have thousands of airplane shots. So a lot of people do a great job in shooting airplanes. You see that all the time. So, as I always tell people when I'm speaking to groups of young photographers, is you have to quickly establish your own unique style because there's thousands of people out there, and now everyone has there's a proliferation of great digital cameras. So you really need to establish your unique look and a style and really pursue that so that you stand out from other, you know, photographers that are out there. So this was a way of approaching in the book the history. There's a lot of historic pictures in it from the Air Force and from contractors, Boeing and Rockwell and Northrop, General Dynamics, Lockheed. And then my pictures intermingled with that, and you told the story of a program. And then the second part of each chapter is, even though it was canceled, what would have looked like in service. So I've established fictional camouflage patterns and squadron markings that, for example, in the F-108 Rapier, which was an interceptor that was canceled, I've taken squadron markings that the F-106 served under, such as the 49th Fighter Interceptor Squadron, and put those markings on an F-108. And so a lot of people have really responded to that and said, oh, that's pretty cool. Look at that. It would have looked really neat. And even the Blackbirds, the Interceptor version of the Blackbird from Lockheed, called the F-12B. I've taken some squadron markings and put those actually on the tail of the Blackbird, which no one's seen that before, so you knew it was something new. So that attracted a lot of attention. The F-12B Blackbird would have been quite an airplane. So all
now,
of that's really interesting.
You're taking these model aircraft shots, and then you're overlaying them onto existing photo backgrounds that you've shot or acquired. I'm going to ask this simple question because there's a lot of our listeners who are probably going, well, what's the magic? Where's the magic? What is the basic tool on the computer that you use? You've told me, but just lay it out for them. Tell them the name.
Well, the computer is a Mac Pro, and the Photoshop program is a CS6, along with Lightroom. And those are
okay. So you're using the same basic tools that every other high-end photographer in the world has access to and uses, correct?
That's correct. Artist uses his paint and palette, everyone has the same, starts off the same way. Everyone has a Canon or a Nikon camera of a certain caliber. It just is what you do with it that's important.
And that's why we call them artists. And I'm going to just say to the listeners, if you get a chance, go look at the Amazon page or our promo page, and you'll get a look at some of the incredible final results off this, because the first time I saw the work that Eric had done, and he is on Facebook, so you can see his work there as well, I frankly was going, my God, that looks like just a regular photo, and it obviously was something more than just a rendering or a wireframe. With that said, let's talk about a couple of different – we're going to go ahead and spend the rest of the show talking about some of the various aircraft that Eric has rendered and created for Project Terminated. If you'd like to go and call in and talk to Eric, please feel free to. Our telephone access number is area code 347-945-7246. Again, that's area code 347-945-7246. Eric, let's go ahead and start a little ways back, even before you and I were born, before, back when dinosaurs walked the earth. And let's talk a little bit about the late 40s and early 50s, that period where so much was happening. The sound barrier was being broken. Aerodynamics was just an incredible place to spend time. Engines were coming on. Jets were the new thing. And one of the things that you just could not get over was the work of a guy named Jack Northrop, who had gotten the idea of a very efficient form for an aircraft called a flying wing. And out of that came a couple of bomber designs that he wanted to build for the U.S. Air Force, including the jet-powered B-49. Talk a little bit about your work with the B-49 in your book.
Yeah, that's a very interesting start there. I'm glad you brought that up because that is the first chapter of the book. And we'll talk a little bit about Jack Northrop and how he got started and started Northrop Company and the flying wing as he looked at some of the ideas of the from Germany that emanated after World War II, the Horton brothers and et cetera, a lot of flying wing designs. The U.S. did under Operation Paperclip, even before the war was about two additional months before World War II ended, before April 1945 in Europe, when they sent people over that could go into areas not under combat, and they retrieved a lot of data from Germans, the wind tunnel testing and so forth, and Boeing looked at swept wings that they later applied to the B-47, so did North American to the F-86. Jack Northrop looked at flying wing designs, and then he went from there. And it was a great design because they didn't even realize it at the time. At one time, the Northrop Flying Wing, the prototype, the YB-49, was flying in off the California coast, coming in toward Edwards. Actually, it was Morauk back then. They radioed in, and they couldn't find them on radar. And it was kind of got lost in the paperwork, but they probably should have noted that at the time. It had a very low signature. But it had a lot of other problems with stability and control. I have interviews and statements that were made back then by the test pilots, Cardenas, et cetera, that it was a great airplane, sometimes flew like a fighter, but certainly wasn't ready to be a bomber because of its stability. So you were flying a jet that was basically a flying wing with no fuselage, small vertical stabilizers across the back. It just wasn't steady enough. The control systems were just not there. And John, you brought up engines. The thrust of the engines, as applied later to fighter aircraft of the 50s, we had some interesting designs, but the fighters' engines were not reliable and didn't generate enough thrust. When you're talking about thrust that maybe 4,000 or 5,000 pounds in a jet engine, where the same size engine basically nowadays in an F-16 gives you over 30,000 pounds of thrust. So there's a big difference there in recovering the airplane in flight and you know, having a safety factor with that extra thrust for performance. So the flying wing had control problems because you're flying this with an unfamiliar aspect ratio of the wing and no fuselage, small vertical tails. So basically there was some politics involved. They probably could have evolved a little bit or kept the test flight program going. There was a reconnaissance version called the YRB-49, and I put some pictures in there of what an RB-49 would have looked like, and also what a camouflaged B-49 would have looked like. So even though this chapter agrees with, yes, it probably should have been canceled, wasn't ready, I do talk about what they would have looked like had they gone into service. They probably should have kept the reconnaissance version operating a little longer, but they put it out in storage out here, out in the open at Ontario Airport, and then in the early 50s it was finally scrapped. There was something back then about scrapping everything, and they were not very interested in preserving history. It would have been nice to have one of those flying wings in a museum today. But basically,
and under the heading of irony, I believe, half a century later, after the development of advanced turbofan engines and something called digital fly-by-wire control, that somewhat unstable, somewhat underpowered idea of flying wings made a very covert comeback, and today, of course, lives in the form of 20 B-2A Spirit bombers, which are functionally identical dimensionally to the YB-49.
Yes, and that is the happy part of the chapter, as I bring that out, the development of the B-2. It's first called the Advanced Technology Bomber, ATB, that was ordered by President Reagan when he took office. And what was really great is a section in the book where, while the B-2 was being developed, Jack Northrop, who was retired, he got special clearance, and they brought him in and showed him what they were working on. And in the book I have his quote. He says, "This is why God kept me alive." So it was very emotional that all his work in the past had paid off, and there was going to be a B-2. 172-foot wingspan, you're right, same wingspan as the YB-49. It has a very low signature and digital flight control system that even though the pilot is flying the airplane, those digital operations are going through the flight controls, keeping everything steady. It has great altitude, it's subsonic, but has that low signature, and the enemy wouldn't even know what hit him because of its extreme altitude at night. The target would just be hit. So it's an incredible device, and you're right, there were 21 of them. They lost one on Guam at Anderson Air Force Base a few years ago, but there's 20 of them. And that's another thing I bring up in the book, because everyone complains, wow, how expensive that airplane was. Well, when President Reagan ordered the B-1B and the B-2 to get started, the original order number was 132 B-2s. So the contractor gets ready to gear up his suppliers, et cetera, to produce that many airplanes. Well, then it was lowered to around 60 a couple of years later. And then finally, they wind up only building 21 instead of 132. Well, look what that, you know, it's basic economics. Look what it does to the unit price. And what I bring in the book, because that's the 1950s up to the 80s, and then the book goes all the way up to the JSF. People don't learn their lesson through history. The first thing they do after a contract award, someone comes along and lowers the unit number. And, of course, what happens? The unit price goes up. It's just amazing. It's 50 years of the same lessons not learned. Not that we really needed 100.
God bless those up on Capitol Hill who don't understand basic economics. There were also a couple of other interesting American aircraft that did not go into production, and these came out of the famous Century Series fighters, which we call because they were the first American fighters that were numbered in the hundreds, beginning with the F-100 Sabre jet, the Super Sabre, built by North American, the very first American supersonic aircraft. There were a couple of those aircraft, though, that didn't make it to production, in particular two that you provide illustrations of, the Republic F-103 and the North American F-108. Talk a little bit about the F-108, because that's actually on the cover of your book.
Yeah, that is correct. That's such a graceful, good-looking airplane that I chose that one to be on the cover, being refueled by a tanker and looking down on it, added drop tanks, even though it never flew and it just reached a mock-up stage, but I figured just like other interceptors, it would be equipped with drop tanks. So I've got four drop tanks on there, similar to the arrangement that North American Rockwell did on the Vigilante with four drop tanks. And the 108 was an exquisite-looking airplane and started in the late 1950s under the Eisenhower administration. And at the time, North American was starting to develop the XB-70. So they had a great plan in operation there that they would concurrently develop a lot of the systems for both airplanes because it was a new field they were getting into of a fast flight, high altitude, and that proved to be expensive. So same engines, a lot of the electronics going into the 108 that would go into the XB-70. So it reached mock-up stage, was doing great in all its reviews, beautiful airplane, would have defended us from incoming bombers because it had the ability to fly about 1,900 miles per hour at 80,000 feet. Pretty good for that time in the late 50s. But as the Eisenhower administration was leaving office, they were real funny about balancing the budget, unlike today. So Maurice Stans, who was Eisenhower's budget manager, was looking for big-ticket items just to can them, so the books would look good. So here's a very expensive aircraft program, the F-108 North American, and it was just suddenly canceled in 1959. They probably didn't even know it was concurrently being developed with the XB-70. And I emphasize throughout each chapter the importance of communication, whether it's Secretary of Defense McNamara or General LeMay or Kelly Johnson from the Skunk Works. Communications was vital because McNamara came in under the Kennedy administration in 1960, and he's going over programs, and that was January 1960 when John F. Kennedy took office. He chose McNamara from the Ford Company. Within 3 months of that, McNamara was making decisions on very complex aircraft programs, and he had come from the automobile industry. And I just wonder how much information he had, because pretty soon he was stripping down the XB-70 program and kind of emasculating it from being an offensive capability. It was basically turned into a research program. And the Valkyrie never really had a chance to prove itself because he probably didn't know that, the XB-70 cost several hundred million dollars more overnight because Eisenhower had canceled the F-108. And back in 1959, $200 or $300 million was a lot of money. That's probably billions in today's dollar. So McNamara was faced with this budget problem caused by this cancellation of another program. So there's a lot of what if, and when something is canceled or doesn't go ahead, it has an effect on other programs. So essentially, the Eisenhower decision to cancel the F-108 Rapier probably doomed the XB-70 right off the bat.
And with that, we're going to do a couple of network messages. We'll be back in a couple of minutes to talk about more canceled aircraft from Project Terminated.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Right Stream and hashtag Right Stream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for Right Stream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. Right Stream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. Right Stream Tuesday with Daria Ann, Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the Right Stream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com, that's L-I-S-A-T-A-R-V-E-S, for details on all the services I offer, information on my book, and my radio show. There are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
And welcome back. This is John Gresham. This is the Military Monday program, and our guest today is artist, author, and photographer Eric Simonson. We're talking about his new book, Project Terminated, which could literally be called an art book about aircraft programs that never made it to the production line and what they might have looked like. Eric, you there with us still, sir?
Yes, I am.
Let's talk a little bit about the fact that the United States was not the only other country that was going and canceling aircraft programs during the Cold War. There were also our good friends, the Canadians and the British, and they both canceled, and I should say controversially canceled, two aircraft programs that people like you and I just, we shake our heads and we just, we look wistfully into the sky wishing those were there, and that would be the Canadian Aero and the British TSR.2. Talk a little bit about those airplanes and what you did with them in your book.
Yes, you described that exactly right. Early in the 1950s, the Avro Company of Canada was developing an interceptor because, as the United States, we felt there was a threat from Soviet bombers, and we always have to remember this was the height of the Cold War, so there was that thinking in effect where we really had to get serious in a lot of aspects to make sure that the Soviets, if we appeared weak in any way, is what I call in the book, it's a common term that was used, Soviet adventurism around the world. If they sensed weakness, you'd see trouble spots develop, whether it was their proxy Cuba sending folks into Angola, even the Soviets invading Afghanistan in the late 70s. There was a lot going on as the Cold War went, you know, from the end of World War II until President Reagan and the Soviet Union broke apart. So that was a long stretch of time. But back then, the immediate threat was Soviet bombers. So the Canadians were putting their best brains to work and developed a beautiful airplane, the CF-105 Avro Arrow. And they were going along pretty well. They had to test the new airframe. The engines weren't quite ready, so they had to put in a General Electric engine that was a little lower thrust, but at least they could get the program underway. There seemed to be impatience in the Canadian government, and you cannot rush these things. And even today, we're looking at NASA. In the month of January, we had the Apollo 1 fire, and we also lost Challenger. And both of those were the result of being pushed before things weren't quite ready. And you can have disaster. The same thing is in aircraft programs. You want to maintain schedule, but safety should be the first item. Now, they never lost an airplane. They had a few problems with it, but wound up, it rolled out, of course, on October 4th, 1957. So they lost a little bit of the press coverage because that was the same day Sputnik was launched. So bad timing there. But they got a great plane off the ground, and they were flying, ready to bring a brand-new engine, the Iroquois engine. So it was great for the Canadian aerospace industry that they had this high-tech going on. But there was pressure from the U.S. included that was telling the Canadians, you know, you really don't need airplanes anymore. Missiles are going to be the future. This was really premature to be saying that because even missiles were in their infancy. And we thought, and McNamara later believed, that everything could be taken care of with ICBMs. They have so many in the Soviet Union, and we have so many, and no one would dare do anything because we're under the MAD theory, and that's mutually assured destruction.
A well-chosen acronym created by no less than Dr. Henry
plan.
Kissinger.
It's what?
Yeah.
I didn't hear what you said there.
A well-chosen acronym created by no less than Dr. Henry Kissinger of Harvard at the time.
Yeah. When you think about living under mutually assured destruction, this doesn't give the president much leeway as a crisis escalates. That's why what we have today, the strategic triad of having submarine-launched missiles, land-based missiles, and manned aircraft, a recallable system. So we were telling the Canadians, oh, you could just fire it. We're going to sell you the Bomark missile, and you can just fire that out there at any Soviet bomber. Well, you have to ID the airplanes. We didn't know how far offshore the bombers would get with atomic weapons. This was a new field. We didn't know whether we would have to launch thousands of missiles just to get a few bomber. So to get rid of airplanes at that earliest stage was not a good idea. We finally wound up selling the Canadians the Bomark and also used CF-101 Voodoos from our Air National Guard, which wound up costing almost as much as the CF-105 would have cost. So they canceled it. All their great brain power and their aeronautical folks came down to work for NASA on our moon program. So it was a blow to their industry when they canceled the CF-105. And there's a lot of people still wondering what happened and what would the Canadians have a great aerospace and aviation industry now, but probably they would have been much more in a leadership role had they continued, you know, building the Arrow. The other one came later in the mid-60s. It was canceled in 1965, the British Aircraft Corporation, TSR-2, which stands for Tactical Strategic Reconnaissance, Tactical Strike Reconnaissance. And this was to replace the subsonic Vulcan bombers, the sort of the flying wing bomber that the British RAF operated, which were subsonic and could not stand up to new Soviet defenses. You're in their position in Europe and in the UK. They're on the front lines of the Cold War. So you really needed to have aircraft and other systems that were going to be really quick in responding to any type of Soviet movement. So the TSR-2 seemed like a great idea for a low-level strike aircraft capable of Mach 1.2 at low level and Mach 2.2 at high altitude. Although later studies show that when you're flying at low level, it's better to go high subsonic speed because it's very uneconomical to go, you know, over Mach 1 at very low altitude. You burn up all of your fuel. So that's why the B-1 does that today. You would think that the British government, which was impatient with the TSR-2, told them to keep testing and hurry up. They never really got to fly more than a dozen flights when that program was canceled. Very controversial, and like the Canadian Arrow, the TSR-2, all the parts, aircraft, and everything were ordered destroyed. And I don't know what it is with scrapping things, but it's sort of I can't understand why they had to destroy everything, although they did save two TSR-2s that are in museums in Great Britain today. But it was a real shame to lose that airplane. The United States offered the F-111, but since that was so delayed in its early development, the British got impatient and canceled the F-111K, which they were supposed to get. So it was a real mess. We also offered them, the Polaris missiles on their submarines. So there was a real mess in that case of canceling that program, a real fine-looking airplane that could have provided Great Britain in a leadership role there also in aerospace. Because after that program, all future programs like the Tornado and Typhoon, the fighters they have today, they are done by consortiums of several companies together and not just the UK in the lead role. So these major cancellations have an impact on your high-tech jobs and your technology.
And I might add that your depictions of them in the book, Project Terminated, these are beautiful airplanes. I mean, if they'd ever gotten into squadron service, they look like something from another world in some cases.
Exactly. And matter of fact, the British were monitoring the Canadians as well as the U.S. Air Force, looking at the great work that Canada was doing on the Arrow. And in the book, I have an Arrow in U.S. Air Force markings. Had we acquired a few to test? And also in the British squadron markings, because it could have possibly been exported to Great Britain as an interceptor. So all of these things are what might have been, but it's great to look at. And the same with the TSR-2 could have gone, if it had been developed, they could have not only been in a lead technology role producing airplanes, they could have exported the TSR-2 to Australia. And I have several views of what the TSR-2 would look like in Royal Australian Air Force markings, because Australia also got the F-111, and they encountered nothing but delays until they finally got that airplane delivered. So they probably would have been happy to get the TSR-2 earlier. Although finally the 111, once it got into service, proved to be a great airplane, but it sure took a long time. But that was a good point. It's great to look at what those things would have looked like.
The next segment we want to talk about is hypersonics, because we have a lot of activity going on right now, both in the research as well as testing of very high speed endo-atmospheric vehicles. But back in the late 50s and the early 60s, people don't realize we were already seriously playing with very high-speed combat aircraft that could have, if people had wanted them to, gone into service. And in particular, we're talking about something called the XB-70 Valkyrie from North American. Of course, the well-known Blackbirds of Lockheed. And something that most people have never heard about, the X-20 Dinosaur. Let's start with the Valkyrie, because I know that's a real favorite for you. And let's not lie here, people. If Marilyn Monroe was an airplane, she would have been an XB-70.
Yeah, how can I follow that? That was a great introduction. Well, you're right.
Talk about the bird.
The XB-70, as I brought up previously, encountered some problems because it immediately had a more expensive price tag due to the F-108 cancellation. But it went into flight test. Unfortunately, Secretary McNamara stripped it of offensive and defensive capabilities, so it didn't have the third and fourth seat behind the pilot and commander to operate those systems. So you essentially was a research program with a two-man crew, and they flew it, achieved Mach 3 above 75,000 feet. The second prototype was built and started flight testing, and it was much improved in a lot of systems. Even the wing dihedral was adjusted, and different things were done to get that airplane to improve its performance. Unfortunately, it was the second prototype that was lost in June 1966 in a mid-air collision. Those things happened, and it was very unfortunate. The program should not have affected the flight test program because it wasn't the fault of the XB-70, but it did happen, and there were a lot of repercussions from it. But the first prototype merely was a research program. It did subsonic boom research for the SST and so forth. But I have a lot of things in the book that McNamara didn't understand about the Valkyrie and how important having a quick strike airplane with tremendous range would have been during the Cold War. Because a lot of people have written to me and responded in emails and said, well, you know, we canceled the program here and there, but we made it through the Cold War. Everything was fine. But, you know, for the people living under the communist bloc since the end of World War II until President Reagan's office, that's millions of people living under the communist regime and suffering. And our service people that ran reconnaissance flights that lost their lives through the years trying to keep track of the Soviet Union. Anything that could be introduced that could shorten the Cold War and tell the Soviet Union, there's no use in pursuing this because there's no way you're going to defeat us. And then they start backing down. And that certainly happened once we had a very strong defense system under President Reagan, including a missile defense system. And if anything that the Soviet Union hates more until today is an effective missile defense system, and others also.
It just makes them nuts.
They invested so much in missiles that can threaten their neighbors and other people that if you suddenly you have something that can defeat missiles, the key. And we were developing what the press called Star Wars, but actually was the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, which really helped bring Soviet Union to its knees there at the end of the Cold War. But getting back to the XB-70, having that fast airplane, because the other air bomber we had was the B-52, very, very slow, even though it's gone beyond 60 years of service now with upgrades. It still doesn't have that penetration capability. And also, the Blackbird family was concurrently being developed, trying to achieve high Mach with different systems. And you mentioned hypersonics. Actually, hypersonic speed is Mach 5 and above. All these airplanes were, in the Mach 3 category. When you get into the X-20 Dinosaur, then you're getting into orbital speeds and hypersonic speed.
And what was the X-20? Obviously, it was a Boeing design for a lifting body-based spacecraft, but it was very, very different from Project Mercury, which was running concurrent to it.
I'm glad you brought that up. This is just a turning point in history that I take a look at because NASA was developing Mercury, Gemini, and then Apollo, but the Air Force was developing a reusable space plane called the X-20 Dinosaur. A single crew member would be mounted on a rocket. First started with the Titan 1. They looked at it. Titan 2 could have done some suborbital flight. And then they moved to the Titan 3, which could bring it to orbit. Although they would have, had it been finished, they would have done some suborbital and then an orbital unmanned and then man it. But here you have a system that could take off, have maneuverability on orbit, come in low, scoot back up, have cross-orbit capability, have all its systems, photographic film and other sensors on board. And the other project at the time that we subsequently developed, Project Corona, and reconnaissance satellites, well, they dropped film canisters into the atmosphere that had to be recovered by air or in the ocean. Then they had to bring those canisters and fly them to the to a base, whereas the X-20 could bring all its systems right back to its home base at Vandenberg Air Force Base, because that's where the polar orbits would be launched, and would have given us a manned, reusable space plane in the 1960s. And the shuttle wasn't even designed, you know, till the 1970s, and then flew in 1981. So having this capability and not the enemy not knowing when you were going to pass overhead because you have cross-orbit capability, such an early period of time, and you didn't have to have a naval fleet out there waiting for it to pick you up in the water, was just a fantastic capability. They got
the
mock-up stage.
The astronauts literally would have been flying the rocket.
Right. It's and they had six or seven prototypes on the Boeing assembly line when Secretary McNamara canceled the program, saying it didn't have a mission. To this day, I really can't understand what that means, because I have a list of the missions it could have done and its capabilities. He introduced the MOLE program as a substitute, Manned Orbital Laboratory, which, of course, used Gemini and dropped everything into the ocean again, just like NASA would do. And you have to have an expensive naval fleet standing by to pick them up, helicopters and everything. So we took a step backward there. And then MOLE happened to be canceled a few years later by Melvin Laird, the defense secretary at the time. So we essentially got nowhere there, but later on, the X-20, had it operated, could have given us some insight. Maybe the space shuttle would have been better and have improved thermal protection system and orbital dynamics by having that X-20 experience. All those things could have happened, but it didn't.
And, of course, it's interesting to note that just this past week, the Sierra Nevada Corporation, as part of NASA's commercial crew initiative, is announcing their first test flight into orbit on board a rocket of a spacecraft that looks a whole lot like Dinosaur did for delivering crews and equipment to the station.
That's exactly right. All of that's coming back, and a lot of the points in the book are the good ideas go back into the drawer, and then, you know, 20 or 30 years later, they come back out again, and they go, wow, this is a good idea. Well, why didn't we do it back then? So it's interesting. You know, we have unmanned capability now, like in the X-37, to do that, because that's unmanned autonomous control has really matured during the past 10 or 15 years. But people realize now the dynamics of and the capability of having a winged space plane that can return to the launch base or whatever runway you want to return it to and not drop by parachute into the ocean. And it's a launch on demand, and the bad guys don't know, you know, what inclination it's going to be in or where it's coming from. So there's a lot of capability there. But those are the things in history. I kind of look at the X-20 and what a larger version would have been like with a four-man crew and things of that nature. But what's really important is how it could have made the space shuttle an even better design. Even though the space shuttle was incredible, there were some things that could have been improved, and we missed that opportunity. But now we're getting the space planes back 40, 50 years later.
And towards the end of the book, you have a couple of chapters dedicated to what we might call some modern cancellations. And I kind of grouped those together, and we'll talk about them here, starting with the B-1A, which was the predecessor to the current B-1B, which is in service, something called the XV-12 from Rockwell, of all places, in Columbus, Ohio, the F-20 Tiger Shark, which was to have been a lightweight fighter that was a contemporary of the F-16, and one that's a handful of people may remember, something called the A-12 Avenger, known as the Flying Dorito. Let's start with a B-1A and tell its little story here.
B-1A, the manned bomber to get something go in low and fast, was being developed by North American Rockwell. Had a low successful flight test with four prototypes and was going pretty good. Then Jimmy Carter came into office and promised that he would be canceling that program. It was a sort of a campaign promise. But after being in office for a while and undergoing briefings, he came up with some substitutes, such as a 747 launching cruise missile and other things, trying to find anything but approve that bomber. So it was the following June 1977, that a lot of people still remember, all of a sudden the B-1A was canceled. Within a few years, the Soviets, and I talked to people that are in the book that saw people at the Paris Air Show and different aviation events, that people from the Russian embassy would come over to them and said, boy, you guys really screwed that one up, because the Soviet Union kind of took that as a hint that we were going to be very passive. And within a couple of years, you had the hostage situation in Tehran, and you had the Soviet Union invading Afghanistan. So those signals that sent by the United States of weakness or passiveness really do not pay off. You know, it's peace through strength, Strategic Air Command's old saying. So remarkably, the Rockwell folks started on day one. They lent out all their engineers to other companies to preserve the technical brain power base. Subcontractors, they kept in touch with them, and for 4 years they worked really hard. So when President Reagan came in the office, it was only a short time after that when Reagan said, there's a window of vulnerability. The Soviet Union can get us in a first strike. So we're sort of sitting ducks here. We need to get our bombers off the ground. The Russians knew they could get the B-52s on the ground, but the B-1 could get off the ground very quickly and up into altitude. So he approved 100 B-1s and start immediately, and 132 ATBs, which later turned out to be the B-2. And we immediately began recovering. So they called people back, the engineering and so forth. Just a lot of hard work by people for 4 years. And recover under that devastating news and to get that program off the ground again. Now it's an incredible bomber. The Air Force calls the B-1 the weapon of choice. It keeps up with the fighter escorts. It's on its own for a long loitering time. Smart weapons have made it extremely effective in Afghanistan. And it's actually the B-1's doing close air support for our ground troops because it's so accurate and it has a long loiter time. It has the supersonic speed. It still goes low-level, high subsonic, but it can do Mach 1.2 at high altitude. So it can scoot over to another area real quickly. So it's great. It does not carry nuclear weapons anymore because that's part of the strategic arms limitation talks with the Soviets or Russia today. But it's conventionally armed with precision-guided munitions. It's a very effective weapon. So that's a happy chapter where we turned things around and got the B-1 back. So on the other one,
The very, very intriguing and amazing-looking airplane, the XV-12 from Rockwell in Columbus, Ohio. Now, that one that's kind of a whack up the side of the head.
Well, actually, it was a very productive division, you know, the T2 Buckeye and the RA-5C Vigilante. You know, a lot of great Navy jets came out of that, the Fury. Great airplanes came out of the Rockwell Columbus division. So they were going to build a...
I still remember people saying that the definition of the speed of heat was defined by an RA-5C Vigilante going very fast, very low in Vietnam.
Yes, quite an effective aircraft. So we had a lot of lessons learned from that, the blown flap and so forth, and they developed a new system that we would have a V-STOL aircraft that would be supersonic, because the Harrier at the time was a subsonic airplane. So they had the system to test it. Very cool-looking airplane. You know, pictures of it in its paint for the rollout and then what it may have looked like in service. Unfortunately, when they brought it to Langley Research Center and tethered it on the same device as the astronaut used to simulate moonwalking, it didn't develop enough thrust. And I talked to the engineer, interviewed him for the chapter, and had they had computational fluid dynamics at the time, they probably could have read the readings a little better to get that working, but they didn't. And they really tried the tethering for several months, and the Navy became disenchanted with it because we weren't getting the lift we needed for that. And in the chapter, so the program was in trouble. The Navy cut some funding and canceled the second prototype, which is a serious mistake for morale. And when you have a test flight program, it's always better to have two airplanes. So there were a few mistakes there. But I asked, my opinion on it was, why didn't you fly the airplane out of Columbus conventionally and prove it aerodynamically and fly it supersonic and then start working on the V-STOL, because they were going to be on sea control ships at the time, which required a vertical lift, and it could land it okay once you expend the fuel and ordnance. And, you know, they really couldn't answer that question. You know, they kind of should have done that, woulda, coulda, shoulda. But the point I made in the book is that the Harrier made its first flight conventionally. The JSF, going to the Marines and the RAF, the F-35B, is no longer V-STOL, but it's STOVL, and it made its first flight conventionally. They found out
STOVL means short takeoff vertical landing. In other words, it is not designed to take off with a load vertically. It is only designed to take off in a short field or short deck configuration, then after expending weapons and fuel can go ahead and land vertically. Correct.
That's exactly right. And you get more pound for your buck there by going short takeoff. You can carry that load and the British and the, you know, go off a ski jump and so forth to give it an extra boost. So turns out years later, STOVL was out the door. You're paying a heavy price to carry fuel, ordnance, and then lift off vertically. You don't really need to do that, and it really cost us a whole program there by sticking with that STOVL and not trying any other aspect of the airplane as far as flying it. So
maybe the worst crime is it was so cool looking. You have gone and done a number of your pieces of art in a variety of paint jobs, including the Royal Air Force, the U.S. Navy, and Marine Corps, and it's just a gorgeous airplane.
Exactly, because it could have been the Navy could have used it for a while. Then the Navy wanted to go to the Nimitz class carriers and fly bigger jets. That's fine. They could have turned the XFV-12, called it the FV-12, and turned it over to the Marines, and they would have had a great airplane. You know, had everything worked. So just kind of little aspects of history. Yeah, I got the Royal Navy, Royal Air Force markings there, and a nice looking airplane.
And it would have just torn the Argentines down in the Falklands to pieces compared to the Sea Harrier, which did a fine job.
Exactly. You got supersonic capability. You know, what difference in history would have happened? So
and as you pointed out, These are not just airplanes. They're not just money saved from cancellation. They are forks in the road in military history about what could have been. I mean, when I started the show, we were talking about this is visual alternative history that you're carrying on here, and it's kind of an interesting concept. Another alternative aircraft that would have probably done strikingly well on the international export market was a little thing called the Northrop F-20 Tiger Shark, which was an evolved version of their F-5 Freedom Fighter. Talk a little bit about this and its competition with the F-16 worldwide, and what happened to the program?
Yeah, this is one that not necessarily due to performance, because the F-20 Tiger Shark was incredible as far as performance for its mission, which would have been a relatively short-range interceptor getting off the ground real fast and getting up there to intercept. Would have been perfect for countries in close border regions and so forth, Switzerland, in the Southeast Asia, Taiwan, and so forth. Perfect. So they started the airplane, rolled it out as the F-5G, and this would be an uprated GE engine with tremendous thrust, and basically the same shape as the old F-5 Tiger II, but instead of two engines, as you know, one substantial engine, which gave it incredible maneuverability and dash speed and so forth. And that was under the Carter administration. He turned down a couple of exports, thinking the plane was a little too hot to give to Taiwan, which was free China. It would upset the People's Republic of China, so that was a political decision. And a couple of sales were a little, because Carter felt that we shouldn't be exporting weapons around the world and trying to keep the peace. I have a quote in there. But, you know, our friends have to be protected. So there was a few mistakes made there. Then the marketing folks changed. We want to get away from the F-5 series, so they renamed it F-20 Tiger Shark. So it had a brand new designation, and they offered it to the Air Force. The Air Force looked at it, and Northrop spent I think $1.2 billion of their own money developing the plane, and the Air Force was not buying it yet. And still they went on a marketing run with the airplane. And then President Reagan came into office, and he lightened up the export rules, allowing us to export the F-16. So he made a mistake in the opposite way that Carter did. Carter was restricting everything, and then Reagan said, okay, we need to have our friends strong because the Soviet Union is giving all of their allies the latest MiG-21s, et cetera. So this allowed General Dynamics to offer the F-16, which was competition. They first offered the F-16/79, which is a D-rated engine from what the U.S. Air Force had. And pretty soon our allies were saying, you know, we don't want a second-rate F-16. We want the full... And we want what you guys have.
So we want a good one, yes.
That was a failure. So they uprated it again. Well, that was even more competition for the F-20. So the story gets pretty intriguing. And still, if the Air Force had purchased a few of them, the Allies were saying, well, you're not flying this airplane and then expect us to buy it. So there was a lot of things. And unfortunately, they had two accidents that was not the fault of any mechanical or performance, but it was a G-lock. The pilots just over-G'd the airplane and passed out, it seems, and they lost two airplanes.
It's one of the ironies that this aircraft was so maneuverable, the pilots could literally injure themselves pulling hard turns and maneuvers. I mean, it was just an incredibly maneuverable airplane. And, of course, today its great legacy is that every person flying a fourth and fifth generation aircraft has to take centrifuge training to go ahead and establish their limits and tolerance for G-induced loss of consciousness.
That's correct, and also the G suits have improved. You know, that could have been improved years later with better suits for the pilots, but you know, that was taken into account. It was very unfortunate. I watched the airplane at China Lake, and also at El Toro. There was an air show there, and I could not believe the G's the guy was pulling. I was tracking it with a telephoto, and uh, it it was remarkable. But all in all, that combined, and then GD lowered the price of their F-16s. They tried to save it as a sale, as a Navy aggressor F-20. GD underbid the F-20 all the time. And the Air Force still had some great offers from Northrop. If they just would have purchased that airplane, history might have been different. But finally, Northrop couldn't spend any more money on an airplane the Air Force or Navy wasn't buying, so it was eventually canceled. But a great airplane. There's one hanging in a Los Angeles museum now. But I have some pictures of what the Republic of Korea Air Force and China and the Swiss Air Force would have looked like in markings of the F-20 Tiger Shark. You know, great-looking airplane. I even have a view of the Swiss Air Force flying two of their F-18s with the F-20. And the two F-18s are real airplanes, and then the F-20 is a generated image. And you really, there's several pictures in there where if you place a real airplane flying and then have a simulated concept flying next to it, people are really looking at it going, you know, which one is real? So I like to keep them guessing.
And the last airplane we're going to talk about today, one that has something of a notorious nature, the A-12 Avenger, also known as the Flying Dorito. You actually do produce some interesting artwork of what would have been just absolutely the ultimate vision of Jack Northrop's flying wing, but sadly a program which, between the management incompetence and criminality, just never worked out.
Actually, you know, the artwork that you're showing on the site is a preview of hopefully you get to do another book, because that one, at the time I was doing this book, the program was still in the courts and still unsettled. But it just so happens 2 days ago they finally reached a court settlement with the contractors and the government. So the program, that is concluded, so now I can include the conclusion.
And what would this airplane have done if it had ever been built?
Well, it would give the Navy a strike, attack, and stealth capability off the carrier deck, which they still don't have today, because the Air Force was going along with Hav Blue and the F-117 and the B-2, getting all this great technology and low signatures. So the Navy wanted to do that, so they had McDonnell Douglas and GD work on the A-12, which no one knew what it looked like for many years because it was highly classified, and they were not sharing information with the Air Force on materials and RAM, which is, you know, radar absorbent material, other things, with not enough, and as you brought up, you know, management and not enough information sharing. So the program got into trouble in getting the schedule to meet different demands, even getting the mock-up built for inspection, and then getting actual airplane parts together. So I'm compiling a lot of that data. I put that artwork out there as a preview. So hopefully I get to write that chapter as more information comes out. So it was a beautiful airplane, you know, complete flying wing off the carrier deck with folding wings, wing tips for storage on the carrier. The Navy still does not have that low signature strike. A lot's been incorporated into the Super Hornet, but this was a totally different shape. And the upcoming F-35C JSF, which will be on the carrier decks, still would have a higher signature than the A-12. So it's a real shame the Navy didn't get that, but the program did run into trouble in the Dick Cheney was the Secretary of Defense at the time, who wound up canceling the program. And the court settlement, just announced a couple of days ago, is actually General Dynamics was in on it, and Boeing inherited the A-12 court case from McDonnell Douglas when they had the merger. Yeah.
So, And with that, let's talk about what you're going to do. I mean, you've obviously created quite a bit of buzz in the aviation and book community with this volume you've put out there, Project Terminated. I imagine it's going to sit on a lot of coffee tables of aviation geeks and enthusiasts around the world. How is it sold? How are you doing with the book?
Well, so far we've gone through two printings in less than a year, and almost done with the second. I, you know, received a notice that there could be a third printing, so we're taking a look at that, and I'm just waiting for a notice on that, which is because it was released in March of last year, so we're coming up on, you know, a couple of months will be 1 year anniversary of its publishment. So hopefully that that'll take place, and you know, a lot of good feedback, and because of its size and the color quality done by Cressy, the you know, the people really enjoy getting into looking at the photographs in its dimensions.
Oh, it's just a visual voyeurism thing. If you're an aviation nut, like hypothetically I might be, this book will go ahead and waste a good evening or three before you're done with it.
Yeah, not only the art, but there's a I think it's up to 1,000 words or something of history in there of things that went on behind the scenes, and some of the people that I interviewed, the F-108 and the XB-70 that are still around. They worked at North American. I talked to Sam Icavelis, who is the program manager of the B-1B, provided a lot of inside data on development of that and the history, you know, of Northrop and North American, you know, and all the different companies that developed these amazing aircraft, and the Boeing X-20 Dinosaur, which certainly was a generation ahead. And if some people had made the right decision, you know, it would have gone ahead. So it's interesting to look and wonder why some people made certain decisions and they had no idea the effect on history. Some people were concerned with, I'm going to go to my boss and look how much money I saved. But, boy, you were really affecting a lot of people by just saving a little money here when down the road you'd wind up spending more to replace that system you already had. So it's really interesting to look at. History is just fascinating, no two ways about it.
What's next for you, Eric? What are you working on now? What are you going to do next?
Well, I'd like to do one on fly-offs, you know, competitive type competitions that took place recently. You know, TFX that established the F-111 controversy there. Of course, right up to date, a changing story every day, JSF, all started with JAST, evolved into JSF. That's still an ongoing interesting story and development of that. The Advanced Tactical Fighter, ATF, which gave us the F-22. And, boy, that Northrop YF-23 sure was a nice-looking airplane, and I already have the F-23 as an operational airplane in camouflage, sort of getting some artwork together. I don't have any go-ahead for anything yet, but you constantly have to work to gather material and keep ahead of the game and come up with new ideas. Also, there was a competition with the YB-60 developed by Convair against the Boeing B-52. How did we get that bomber? There was also, you know, the B-57 came from the Canberra from Great Britain, and it beat some American bombers, the Martin XB-51 and so forth. So there's some little competitions there, and of course what I mentioned that people are very interested in how the JSF is evolving, and also the ATF, which gave us the F-22. And there's another thing that could go down in history as a possible mistake. Originally, we were supposed to have over 600 F-22s, which is a remarkable. People really don't know all the capability of the F-22.
And what
Raptor.
We got was 187.
That was done by Secretary Gates before he left office, and thinking that the F-35 was going to be coming along okay, but we need to look at that decision. Historians need to look at that because we had everything in place, the Marietta production line at Lockheed Martin, the technical attributes in line, the subcontractors, a fantastic airplane, And then all of a sudden it's limited. Maybe we didn't need 650, but some Air Force generals have stated what the number was, and it was kind of halfway between
442,
another half of what we have. About
around
twice 187 is what we need, because you know China is expanding in the Pacific region. We're being stretched thin. Oh, and another competition you reminded me of, the A-10 versus the A-9.
The Northrop 9, yes.
Yeah, and it's really interesting.
Very different interpretation of the AX requirement back then.
Right, and of course the A-10 Warthog is doing a fantastic job, but people are talking about retiring it and thinking the JSF is going to take its role. I don't think you're going to bring a $100 and $120 million JSF down really low for close air support. And the A-10, you know, has been upgraded by Boeing has put new wings on it, and Lockheed Martin has put a new glass cockpit, and they've spent a lot of money keeping the A-10 up to date. And they have communications gear where they work with drones and they work with ground attack, and it's got a 30-millimeter cannon. Retiring that would be a huge mistake. So the competition was interesting because the YA-9 built by Northrop lost, but the Russians went and built the Su-25 Frogfoot. It looks just like...
Which looks a whole lot more like an A-9 than an A-10, obviously, yeah.
Exactly. So that's interesting. I'll have the Frogfoot in there, have the A-9 if it had gone ahead into service, and say some great things about the A-10 and the mission that's performed for close air support. But that F-22 number is something that really struck a chord with me in limiting the production of that when we were not sure how the F-35 was going to do. It was supposed to be the high-low mix, like the F-16 was the cheap low-mix fighter and the high was the F-15. That's another kind of, and that was supposed to be the mix. So it's supposed to be F-22 high and the F-35 low. But now the F-35 is getting to be more expensive than the F-22. So we got to look at that.
Anyway, we will continue this discussion hopefully another day when you've got another book or another project to show. Eric, I want to thank you for coming on and having just a geek fest with me. I really loved it.
Oh, great. It's a pleasure talking to someone that really knows their stuff and can ask great questions and knows a lot about the history.
Well, thank you for coming on. I hope you continue to do well with sales of this book, and I hope somebody has the good sense to publish another one of your books.
Well, I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Take care. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you, sir.
And with that, we're finished up with another session of Military Monday. I hope you all have a great week ahead. Stay warm for the next couple of days while the polar vortex gives us another sideways whack. And we will talk to you next week. Take care.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. Got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? Saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. And he said that he's coming for me. I never loved a soldier until the walls were warm. cherished freedom. Freedom never cries. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my.
Yeah.